I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Vanessa Hua's new novel, Coyote Land, is set in the tense time immediately following the COVID-19 outbreak. The world is back open, but people are masked up and still extremely cautious. This setting tees up a multitude of challenges among four families living in El Nido, a neighborhood in California's Bay Area. From racial tensions to economic hardships to a coyote attack, it's safe to say these characters are dealing with a lot. I recently spoke with Vanessa Hua about the very real issues that made up her novel, and of course, we had to chat about coyotes as well. Here's our conversation. So can you give our listeners a description of Coyote Land? Because there's a lot going on in this book.
Yeah. So Coyote Land is about wealth, privilege, and the housing market, as well as territory, predator, and prey. It tells the story of four families in a community, one Black, one white, one Guatemalan, one Chinese, and the conflicts that ensue. But also the allyship that ensues as well.
Setting, I want to place this book setting-wise, because it plays a large part in the story of the book. Can you talk to me about El Nido? What should we know about this area and the families who reside here?
Yes. The novel is set in the hills east of Berkeley, though I like to think of it as also a state of mind because it reflects the battles over housing and who belongs that are happening all over the United States. But something to consider specific to this novel is how it really sits between the urban wildlife interface, that even though you have cul-de-sacs, you have sidewalks and tidy houses, you look up and coyotes, wild turkeys, and deer are on parade. And that sort of encroachment on through development is, again, something that plays out everywhere, but really speaks to the nature of, territory. Not, how do we get along not only with our animal neighbors, but with the people next door?
There are some heavy topics in Coyote Land, and I'd like to touch on several of them. And let's start with race or nationality. The four families in the book are the Changs, the Bells, the Washingtons, and the Rodriguezes, the four main families. And you've already mentioned their nationalities, but, beyond those labels, there were deeper questions about race in the book, questions of passing by Lucinda Stewart, a woman who lived in the area years ago. And I was also wondering about Sam passing. What did you want to explore about race?
I think often depictions of race can be surface level or they can be binary, right? Race in America, when it's discussed, is often Black or white. And really, the experiences I've had as a journalist and as a person of color, I know it's much more complicated than that. And I wanted the novel to reflect the reality as it is and not as, not with these outdated portrayals. During research for the book, I found that, in 1990, in metro suburbs, it was about 20% minority, but as of 2020, it's now 45%. So, and the majority of Americans live in suburbs. Yet we have all these outdated sort of homogenous portrayals. And I think, what I wanted to do or in Coyote Land is to show, again, the reality that's complicated and nuanced and can provide it's an interesting new set of conflicts, but also an interesting new set of ways that people might find they have common ground.
Coyote Land takes place against the backdrop of the COVID-19 pandemic. Toward the second wave of this pandemic, schools and businesses are open, but people are heavily masked up and there's still an underlying fear. The kids who have gone back to school are on a short fuse sometimes. Why was this setting the perfect sort of pressure cooker for the action of this book?
Thank you for asking. I'd seen novels set sort of in the first wave of, lockdown, squired away in a country home. But I found 2021 to be rich territory to mine, because as you said, it was halfway open and halfway not. And there'd been a reckoning in 2020 in so many ways about health, about race, about climate. So we get to 2021 and the question is, do we go back to the way we were? Is that our goal? Do we try to strive for something better? Or does the pendulum swing in the other direction to even worse? And we're in 2026 now, and you know, the timeline has played out as it's played out. But as a novelist, I really think hinge points like 2021 are so valuable to explore.
I also liked the way one of your characters, who was a doctor, was dealing with the loss of, you know, this the sense of smell and taste and that journey and the research into getting that back for her. You mentioned climate change, and your characters were also affected by wildfires, weren't they?
Yes. So in the fall of 2020, in addition to the pandemic, in addition to the, you know, the nationwide protests, in the Bay Area, it was the day the sky turned orange, as it's known. We woke up, the birds were not singing because they were confused, that they thought it was still nighttime. It was so eerie. It was like we'd woken up on Mars. And it just, you know, 2020 was really a year of converging, overlapping crises. But even aside from 2020, in California, we're always worried about snowpack levels. Is this going to be a bad wildfire season? But, and as we've seen, this is, the wildfires can happen here, but then the smoke can travel all the way across the country. Like I was teaching in Tennessee and talking to someone, he said, oh, this, you know, why is it so hazy? And it had just, we were all connected. Even if the wildfires seem far away, they affect us all and are reflective of a warming planet.
You're listening to Marginalia. Our guest today is Vanessa Hua, and we're talking about her novel, Coyote Land. So, you know, we're talking about themes in this book, and they all feel so taut. You explore debt, rising costs, living beyond our means because we feel like we need to do better by our kids. I think there was a line in Blair Bell's section, the more you earned, the more you spent. Talk to me about this.
Yes, this novel also explores class, which is such an interesting, sensitive topic in the U.S. because we have this notion of equality, right? And also social mobility, that we have this, you know, that's the basis of the American dream. And yet even people who are by outward appearances doing well, they're feeling pressed. They are struggling to hold on. And so I think it just speaks to, no matter, you know, how much you're making right now in the US, you know, the struggles that families have. And again, it's often driven by concerns for their children, and people do not feel secure no matter how much they're making.
Can you talk about what you wanted to explore with regard to surveillance? I mean, one of your characters worked for a company called Orb, which is this this technology, this ability to put cameras just about anywhere. What did you want to explore here?
I'm really interested in surveillance, not only in things like these cameras that capture everything from, you know, car accidents to wildlife sightings, but also self-surveillance through social media, the way people, you know, the teenagers will post themselves and perform. And there's an idea, you know, of the panopticon that more surveillance will bring more security, but in fact, it's all an illusion, right? And it causes, you know, if the surveillance figures into the plot in multiple ways, and I hope readers will find much to discuss about the role of surveillance in the book and in their lives.
Well, here's another happy topic, body dysmorphia.
I will say this, people have said the book's also funny.
It is. You even touched on autism. What did you want the reader to think about with these topics?
Yeah. Let let me make clear, I didn't start with like a list and go top down. Like it's going to be, you know, after school movie of the week. But again, I wanted to write, to create characters who are as reflective of the way we live now. And that's complicated, right? And that even characters who are doing something questionable, you kind of understand. I wanted to be able to depict the pressures that are shaping them, and what's in their life. So even if you don't agree with what they've done, at least you come to a better understanding. Because I think right now, a lot of times things are so divided because we are not understanding the full picture of what pressures people are under.
I was visiting with our producer, Haley, about the book and talking about just everything that you touch on in the book. And then we did decide that, yeah, this is very reflective of our world today. It's not too much. It was just, you know, examining what we are all living with. So we do have to talk about the coyote of the title, Wiley. The name of the book is Coyote Land. We even get Wiley's perspective at times. What inspired this theme?
So in a way, it was almost an inspiration for the book. During the early days of the pandemic, I was out for a morning walk when I heard what sounded like the clatter of high heels. I don't know if you've ever heard deer running on asphalt, but that's what it sounds like. People running in high heels. And I turn and I couldn't believe my eyes. A coyote was running at me full tilt, chased by two deer. They ran right past and then jumped into the brush. And it just seemed like another sign of a world off kilter. And I chatted with a neighbor later who'd seen what happened sort of on the other end of the street. The deer had gone down into a ravine, the coyote followed. And I think the deer realized they were two against one and turned tail. So I live in a neighborhood where, you know, a coyote sighting will set off alarm text between neighbors, like, you know, lock your doors, hold, you know, bring your pets in. But I also, there's a fascination with coyotes. I was at a dinner party and a woman mentioned, oh, this poor coyote, he looked like he had the mange. So I bought some medication and put it in some raw meat and put it out for him. So I think I and a lot of people are endlessly fascinated with coyotes because they're so adaptable. You see them in cities, suburbs. I read that they're in every state except for Hawaii. And I have no doubt there will be a stowaway someday and they'll make it to the island. So I think for me, I didn't want to sentimentalize Wiley or turn him into a cartoon character. But as with the other points of view I portray, just getting at like what's driving him and sort of how he's trying to survive and find a way through.
I crossed paths with a coyote on a run a few years ago. And when I got home, I looked up, you know, what's the likelihood that a coyote would attack a human? And I read that it's more likely that I would be struck by an errant golf ball or a champagne cork. And I thought, well, great.
Right.
Two more things to worry about.
Right, exactly. I'd much rather see I think mountain lions are scarier to run into. So.
And what do you say to the people who pronounce it coyote?
I actually did some research into that. There's a huge, by region, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the people who pronounce it coyote do tend to treat it more as an enemy. So, but you know, you do you. So.
Can you talk about the significance of The Ones Who Walk Away from Amelus by Ursula K. Le Guin and its influence on Coyote Land? You also included part of it in your epigraph.
Yes. So it's probably one of her most famous stories in which it's told like a fable. There's a seeming utopia. You know, there's the arts. People are happy, fulfilled. But in exchange, there is one starving child who's kind of kept in the dark. And in the story, it talks about how people are outraged, but sort of tell themselves that this is the deal we've made. like the greater good. And, but a few will leave. And to me, a friend in my writing group, I knew the story, but a friend in my writing group mentioned it to me when we were talking about that idea of sort of the way systemic inequality that are baked in, right? And that people are outraged about, but in the end aren't quite able to shift or to leave because we're caught in those systems. So for the characters, it's something they're reading in AP psychology class, the high schoolers. But it helps them come to understand the systems that they're in, and thinking about the ways in which you can acknowledge it and try to resist it in your own way, but to also understand the greater forces at work, while at the same time not feeling helpless about it.
Is Coyote Land your third novel?
It is my third novel, yes. My third novel and fourth book.
We've talked about all three novels now.
Yes. Thank you so much.
How did writing Coyote Land compare to your previous two novels?
When you write a novel, you've learned how to write that novel. So, you know, it's interesting. My first two novels, those did start as short stories that I realized, you know, I want to keep going. Not that novels are long short stories, but I would say Coyote Land, from the beginning, I knew was going to be a book-length project. And from the beginning, I knew there would be this rotating cast point of view, because it's a story of a community. And that was an exciting challenge. I think with every book, it should both be exhilarating and terrifying. Can I pull this off? And that's what's shared between my books.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from Coyote Land?
I hope they will feel welcomed into this world, that they'll be kept up wondering what will happen to these characters, that they'll care for them, and that it will help open conversations in their families and in their communities.
Well, the book is Coyote Land. Vanessa Hua, thank you so much for joining us again today.
Thank you for having me on.
Coyote Land by Vanessa Hua was published by Flatiron Books. And now, book critic Suzanne Perez looks at a darkly comic novel that takes its inspiration from another work of fiction.
In the author's note for their new book, Evil Genius, Claire Oshetsky writes that the novel owes its existence to a John Cheever short story titled The 548. The 1954 Cheever story is about a businessman named Blake, who has a coercive sexual encounter with a secretary named Ms. Dent, and then fires her. The story does not directly state that Blake raped Ms. Dent, but that's certainly the suggestion. Full of rage, Ms. Dent follows Blake to the train station and forces him at gunpoint to kneel before her with his face in the dirt. As he grovels and weeps, she says, "Now I can wash my hands of you." This moment of revenge and self-affirmation isn't nearly enough for Oshetsky, though. They write in the author's note that, "Ever since I first read The 548 in 1976, I've wanted to put a weapon in Ms. Dent's hand and to give her the confidence to defend herself against Blake's needy fondles." Evil Genius is not a retelling of the Cheever story, but it does pay homage to it. Oshetsky's main character is Celia Dent, a 19-year-old telephone company employee in a soul-crushing job and an even more horrible marriage. The setting is 1970s San Francisco, and Celia keeps telling herself that she's lucky to have her job and her Drew, a domineering and rageful man who doesn't actually hit her, but does control, demean, and gaslight her at every opportunity. Celia's naive contentment with her life is challenged when a woman she knows from work is murdered in a love tryst gone awry. She starts wondering what it would be like to die for love, or to kill for it. That leads her to start socializing with her coworkers, pushing boundaries, and discovering herself in a whole new way. I have not read Oshetsky's previous novels, Schwet, which was long listed for the Penn Faulkner Award in 2022, or the more recent Poor Dear. The author is known for surreal and unsettling fiction, and this new novel offers that in a big way. Evil Genius explores complex themes of obsession and desire, with a darkly comic style and a storyline that twists, turns, and goes places you never expect. The novel has been billed as horror, historical fiction, and as mystery thriller, but it doesn't really fit neatly into any of those boxes. This is bizarro literary fiction, and more than anything, a young woman's coming-of-age quest to throw off the dull reality of her daily life and imagine something better. There are guns and knives, and a particularly creepy scene involving a pantry full of headless Barbies. And I imagine readers will either love it or hate it. Count me among the ones who appreciate Oshetsky's original voice and wry humor. This is a clever, fiendish, wild ride, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. For Marginalia, I'm Suzanne Perez.
Evil Genius by Claire Oshetsky was published by Echo. Joining us now is Camden Avery, co-owner and lead buyer at Booksmith in San Francisco, California. Welcome to Marginalia, Camden.
Thank you so much. It's really nice to be here.
Camden is here to talk about new books, forthcoming titles, and books he just can't stop thinking about. What's on your stack today?
Yeah, thank you for asking. The book mostly that I am obsessed right now with and can't stop thinking about is Ali Smith's new novel. It's called Glyph. Not to be confused with her book of a little over a year ago, which is also called Glyph. This one is spelled different, which is a gag that I think only Ali Smith can get away with. But it's wonderful. It is... I love her so much because she's so intensely smart, and you can feel it on every page, but she has such a light step, and she's so kind of flirtatious and playful and witty and goofy. And this is really a book about two sisters, and it's about their family past and the bigger past, history, social history, sort of erupting into their lives at a difficult moment and bringing them back together. And the form in which history is erupting into their lives is a horse that shows up in one of their bedrooms and starts wrecking the furniture. And it's a horse that's sort of a ghost of history and a ghost of all of the horrible and wonderful things that humans do to each other over time. And they're both trying to figure out what that means and how to accommodate space for this crazy horse in their life.
Sounds interesting.
It's wild. It's really wonderful.
Fantastic. What else is on your stack today?
Yeah, you know, I just read, I think of these two writers in tandem with each other, but Deborah Levy has a forthcoming book called My Year in Paris with Gertrude Stein. And it's sort of an extended, exploded essay about Gertrude Stein and about Stein's relationship with Alice Toklas and different forms of queer homemaking and queer self-making and how our domestic and artistic practice allows us to shape who we become and edit who we become. And so it's a novel or a fiction, but it is about a figure very like Levy, who is inquiring into the life of Gertrude Stein and what that means for her and what it takes to be modern and what we have to sort of get rid of in our lives in order to be modern and in order to allow ourselves to move forward in time. And so that's My Year in Paris with Gertrude Stein by Deborah Levy. This is exciting. Sorry, I'm going to, if it's okay, take a second and walk around and see what else. Normally I pull a stack, and I wanted to be a little bit more spontaneous and sort of see what emerges. So you're going to go on a walk with me through the store here.
I love getting this view of your store.
Thank you. Yeah, you can see the whole, this is, here we are. Yeah. Another book. This is another Bay Area connection, okay? Another book that I'm really excited to finally be able to hand people. Karen Tei Yamashita is the writer of I, Hotel. She's a really celebrated, incredible writer's writer and also just an incredible writer of any kind. She has a novel out called Questions 27 and 28. And it's a really special novel for where we are, I think, culturally in general, but also for California and the Bay Area. The title comes from a questionnaire that was part of an intake form for Japanese internment camps during World War II. And without giving too much away, I think her approach to history and her approach to sort of asking who we are and how we've gotten to where we are is always so exciting and fresh and different. And I think this one is going to land really well for people who are, you know, like so many of us, trying to puzzle out sort of why the world is shaped the way it is right now. Yeah. And so that's questions 27 and 28 by Karen Tei Yamashita.
Okay. Do you have anything else on your stack today?
The other book that's really looming large in my mind this year is The Disappearers by Marlon James, comes out this fall. Marlon is one of my favorite writers of any kind. He's returning in The Disappearers. He's returning to realist fiction after a little wander through speculative fiction. And this is about, it's loosely tied to his actual life, but it's about a group of queer people who are like living, making a life for themselves, expanding the lives that they have in Jamaica in the 80s and 90s, which is still, and it was especially then, a difficult place to be a queer person. So like everything that we love in a Marlon James book, it's voluptuous, it's multifaceted, it's just such a pleasure and a treat to spend time with these characters on the page. And it feels like he's doing something new in his craft and for himself and expanding into a new territory. And I was so excited to hear that he won a Guggenheim Award just a few weeks ago.
Oh, nice.
So yes, that's Marlon James's new novel, The Disappearers, which is going to come out in early fall.
Okay, now I have a question that's not quite fair because I did not give you a heads up. But
okay, great.
If you could sell just one book for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Good question. One book, I would have to say, it's like choosing a favorite child. This is a weird one, and it's not the kind of book that I think most booksellers think of as being their favorite, but there's an older book called Pattern Language by Christopher Alexander, and it's not a novel. It's like architectural theory, and so bear with me, but like I always explain it to people as being like it's an unusual book. It's unlike anything else, but it's a book that's so generous and sort of free-spirited that it is able to comprehend lots of different aspects of life. And it's really just about how human beings live with and engage in their spaces. And so it's sort of like a poetics of, you know, space, to borrow someone else's title. It's a way of thinking about what sort of rhythms and movements humans intuitively love and respond to. And I think that gets borne out in how we live in space, but it also gets borne out in how we live through books and what we see and respond to. So that's like my personal big, big book. Yeah.
You have given us a lot of books to think about. You can find a list of these titles at kmuw.org. Camden Avery, co-owner and lead buyer at The Booksmith in San Francisco, California, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
And thank you for joining us for Marginalia. Tune in next week as we visit with Ayelet Waldman about her new novel, A Perfect Hand.
You know, I wrote this book because these are the works of fiction that I love. I reread all of Jane Austen, not Northanger Abbey, let's be real, but I read all the rest of Jane Austen every year.
Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.